Hello and welcome to Paradox Podcast, episode 29. This week we will be in 2 Kings chapter 3, and this is the story of King Jehoram. Yes, King Jehoram. Not many people talk about King Jehoram. But the story of King Jehoram has some very interesting insight as to what it means to be human. So that's why I thought we would tell the story of King Jehoram. Now, a couple things you need to know before we tell the story of King Jehoram. The first thing is, Israel was split into two countries. There was the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. And King Jehoram was the king of the northern kingdom, which was Israel. Now, in the southern kingdom, there was a man named Jehoshaphat, who was the king of the southern kingdom. And Jehoshaphat might be the best biblical name of all time. So here you have two countries that used to be one. King Jehoram in the north and King Jehoshaphat in the south. And the story begins by Moab, which is a kingdom to the east, rebelling against Israel, the northern kingdom. The king of Israel, Jehoram, cannot stand for this, so he travels to the south to the kingdom of Judah. He appears before the king of Judah, Jehoshaphat, and says these words to him. He says, "The king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you, Jehoshaphat, go with me to battle against Moab?" Jehoshaphat considers his offer and then says, "I will, King Joram. I am with you. My people are your people. My horses are your horses." And so the two kings march south around the Dead Sea through the kingdom of Edom in order to go to battle against the kingdom of Moab. Now, along the way, they come across the kingdom of Edom and they talk to the king of Edom, who does not receive a name in this story. So he's just known as the king of Edom. And they tell the king of Edom their story and how they are going to go into battle together against the kingdom of Moab, and the king of Edom agrees to join them. And so now the party against Moab is not one king, it's not two kings, but three kings. And they are marching through the kingdom of Edom when a severe drought hits, and they did not bring enough water. And so the Bible tells us that they did not drink for 7 days. Now, this greatly impacted the morale of the troops and the morale of the kings. In fact, the king Jehoram was so depressed over this that he says in 2 Kings 3:10, "Alas, the Lord has summoned us three kings only to be handed over to Moab." King Jehoram is convinced that God has brought this alliance together to kill all three kings and their kingdoms. But Jehoshaphat is a bit more of an optimist. He turns to King Jehoram and says, "Is there no prophet of the Lord here through whom we may inquire of the Lord? After all, if God is on our side, as Jehoshaphat reasons, then God will take care of us through this drought." And so a servant of Jehoshaphat speaks up and says, "Elisha, son of Shaphat, who used to pour water on the hands of Elijah, is here." Now, if you listened to last week's podcast about the prophet Elisha, this is the chapter after the story that we talked about in last week's podcast. This is the same Elisha who just watched two bears maul 42 children. In other words, he's not a real friendly, fuzzy, empathetic chap. But the servant says there's this new prophet in town, and he follows the ways of Elijah, and Elijah was a great prophet in their mind. So the three kings go to visit Elisha. When Elisha sees these three kings with these armies approaching him, he goes to the three kings and he says these words. He says, "What have I to do with you? Go to your father's prophets or to your mother's." Why does he say these things? Because Elisha is not the most fuzzy chap for a prophet. These words, these harsh words, fill Jehoram with despair once again. He says, No, it is the Lord who has summoned us, three kings, only to be handed over to Moab." In other words, Jehoram is very much like the Eeyore of the three kings. In response to these hopeless words, Elisha piles on the guilt. He says, "As the Lord of hosts lives, whom I serve, were it not that I have regard for King Jehoshaphat of Judah, I would give you neither a look nor a glance." Basically, Elisha says, "I like one of the three of you, and in case you're not sure which one it is, I like Jehoshaphat. And I'm going to help you not because of you two, Jehoram and the unknown king of Edom. Instead, I am just going to help this king because he's on your side." Now, shortly after that, he then says, "Get me a musician." Because a common practice back then was when people were inquiring of the Lord, they would invite a musician to play music, and it was a transcendent experience, and that would elicit prophecy from a prophet. So Elisha says, "Get me a musician." We then read, "And then while the musician was playing, the power of the Lord came on Elisha." Now, we don't have a recording of the music that Elisha listened to, obviously. However, archaeologists have been able to uncover instruments from the 9th century BCE when this story happened, so we can take a guess at what this music sounded like. And I have a recording of that here with me now. Elisha began to prophesy based on the music that sounded something like this. "Hey, I just met you. That's funny. I don't care who you are. He didn't really listen to Carly Rae Jepsen, but he listened to some music that brought forth a prophecy, and he says this prophecy in the next three verses. God tells Elisha, "I will make this wadi," which is a ravine, "I will make this wadi full of pools. You shall see neither wind nor rain, but the wadi shall be filled with water so that you shall drink, you, your cattle, and your animals. You three kings shall conquer every fortified city and every choice city. Every good tree you shall fell, all springs of water you shall stop up, and every good piece of land you shall ruin with stones." That is the prophecy that Elisha relayed to the three kings. And immediately their hearts were filled with joy. After all, they had been told that the drought would end, they would be able to drink again. Not only that, but once they saw the water, they would know that God was on their side. And if God was on their side, then they could go into battle against the Moabites, confident that God would give them victory over their enemies. And so the three kings went to bed that night, and then they woke up and were shocked to hear running water all around them. God had delivered on God's promise. The wadi was filled with water, and there was water everywhere in a land that was filled with drought the day before. You can imagine the three kings just being psyched out of their mind. God is on our side. We are going to win this battle against the Moabites. Now, at this point, the narrative shifts perspective, and we go to the Moabite camp. The narrator of the story informs us that the Moabites had heard there was an alliance against their nation. This alliance of three kings had made them nervous. And when they woke up and they saw water flowing and they saw water in the wadi, they responded by saying, "This is blood. The kings must have fought together and killed one another. Now then, Moab to the spoil." So Moab sees all of this water around and they think it's blood that has been spilled by these kings once they attacked each other. They get ready for battle and they charge against the three kings in battle. They arrive there and are shocked to find that the three kings have not fought each other, but they are still allied against them. And the three kings chase them into battle. We read then in 2 Kings 3:25 that the cities they, the three kings, overturned, and on every good piece of land, everyone threw a stone until it was covered. Every spring of water they stopped up, and every good tree they felled, all in accordance with the prophecy of Elisha. We continue to read, "Only at Ker Harosheth did the stone walls remain until the slingers surrounded and attacked it." Verse 26 then reads, "When the king of Moab saw that the battle was going against him, he took with him 700 swordsmen to break through opposite the king of Edom, but they could not." And as we read this story, we realize that God gave these three kings the victory. Now, I think this story of victory over Moab can teach us a very important lesson. When you face an uncertainty or a problem in life, it is important for you to seek out a man or woman of God first. Then it is important for you to pray more, to have more faith, and then to do more, and God will give you the victory over your enemies and trials. In other words, when you have a problem, just trust God more, and you will have victory in your life. I think that the theology of this story can be summed up in one song quite perfectly, and that song is this. Everything is awesome. There you go, a perfect story of how you need to trust God more and your problems will be solved. But there is a problem with this perfect story. Namely, the perfect story tells a story of people who are uncertain about life, they trust God more, and they're given victory. And while that's a nice and neat and perfect story to preach in front of people on the weekend, if you keep reading the Bible, you realize there's one more verse in this story. And this verse throws the whole thing into peril. 2 Kings 3:27, which is the last verse of this story, says, "Then Mesha, the king of Moab, took his firstborn son who was to succeed him and offered him as a burnt offering on the wall. And great wrath came upon Israel, so that they withdrew from Moab and returned to their own land." This is the story of God saying to his loyal subjects, "I will give you the victory." And they are given the victory until Mesha, the king of Moab, sacrifices his firstborn son to the god Chemosh, which is the Moabite god. And when he sacrifices him, there is such an evil in the air that great wrath is unleashed upon Israel, and they lose the battle. What kind of story is this? Is this a story about how God is powerless in the face of evil? Is this a story about how Chemosh is real? Is this a story that condones child sacrifice? I mean, what on earth do we do with this story? Because this story seems to show that God can't come through on God's promises, which is probably the most popular sermon title in all time American Christianity. What do we do with this story where evil wins, child sacrifice wins, and God can't deliver on what God promises? This story has something to say about humanity today. But in order to understand that, we need to dig a little bit deeper, and we're going to dig a little bit deeper with a little bit of help from my friend, Clint Eastwood. Just over 10 years ago, Steven Spielberg went to Clint Eastwood and said, "Hey, Clint, I bought the film rights to this book, Flags of Our Fathers. I don't have time to direct it because I'm Steven Spielberg and I'm busy. Would you be interested in directing this and I'll help you produce the movie?" Now, Flags of Our Fathers is an interesting movie because it tells the story about the most famous photograph in American history. That photograph is a photograph depicting six Marines planting the American flag after the Battle of Iwo Jima. It is so iconic, it is so famous that it became the sculpture of the Marine Memorial in Washington, D.C. And so Clint Eastwood read through the book, and he thought to himself, this would be a fantastic film. But in order to make it a complete picture, he wanted to make sure that he did due diligence to not just the American side of the story, but the Japanese side of the story. He did this because he later explained in an interview that he wanted to expose the futility of war. And so Clint Eastwood began to research. And what he found was there's not a lot of books in Japan about the Battle of Iwo Jima. So he took a trip to the island of Iwo Jima, and he walked through the tunnels that were the base or the shelter for the Japanese soldiers during this terrifying experience. He walked through all these tunnels that were hand-dug by Japanese soldiers, and he thought about what it must have been like to hear that 100,000 American troops were coming to fight their 20,000 Japanese troops. And as he thought about the cost of battle as he's on that island and the fact that over 25,000 people died fighting on both sides for control of this island, he began to look at who was in charge of these assaults on both sides. He eventually came across the name of the Japanese commander, a man named General Kiribashi. And as he was reading letters by General Kiribashi, he came across a letter that said these things. Kiribashi wrote, "I was in the United States for 3 years there when I was a captain. I was taught how to drive by some American officers, and I bought a car. I went around the states and I knew the close connections between the military and industry. I saw the plant area of Detroit too." And Clint Eastwood read this letter and he said to himself, "Oh my word, the man who fought the American soldiers at Iwo Jima, the man who defended Iwo Jima on the Japanese side, spent 3 years in our country and showed nothing but appreciation toward our culture." And then Clint Eastwood heard another story of another soldier who died on Iwo Jima. His name was Baron Takichi Nishi. And Baron Nietzsche actually competed in the Olympic Games in 1932 in Los Angeles and won a gold medal for the equestrian events. Here was a man who then had to fight the American soldiers on Iwo Jima. And Clint Eastwood thought about these stories of these two men. He thought about the tunnels. He thought about the fact that there was this human element to the side of the enemies of the American people. And he went back to Steven Spielberg and he said, I think it's time for the story of this battle to be told from the Japanese point of view. Steven Spielberg heard the idea and he said, so what do you propose? And Clint Eastwood said, why don't we make two movies? One from the American point of view and another from the Japanese point of view. Same battle, different stories, different perspectives. Steven Spielberg loved this idea. And so he helped to produce a second movie, a movie about the Japanese perspective on the Battle of Iwo Jima. Now here's where Clint Eastwood did something brilliant. Instead of thinking he understood the Japanese perspective perfectly, he said to himself, if I tell this story, if I write this story, then I will miss what is actually going on because no matter how hard I try, I'm not Japanese. And so he went and he found a screenwriter, a woman named Iris Yamashita, and he commissioned her to write the script from the Japanese perspective. And so what happened was after years of filming, they eventually released the movie Flags of Our Fathers, and then just a few months after that, Clint Eastwood released a movie from the Japanese perspective called Letters from Iwo Jima. Now, here's where Iris Yamashita is brilliant. She begins the story by having a voiceover of a soldier, a man named Saigo. And Saigo is digging. It's the first thing that we see when we were brought to the island of Iwo Jima. He is digging and he's digging, he's digging. And we hear in a voiceover, it says, we soldiers dig. We dig all day. This is the hole that we will fight and die in. Am I digging my own grave? It is absolutely brilliant because that is what the whole movie is about, is that these people are fighting simply to die. And the story is told completely from the perspective of the disposable soldier, not just the Japanese soldier, but in Flags of Our Fathers from the perspective of the American soldier. Now, as the story progresses in Letters from Iwo Jima, we see how Saigo has fallen in love and has married the woman of his dreams. And then his wife reveals that she is pregnant with his son. It is a touching scene. And shortly after that, Saigo receives notice that he needs to come and fight in the Japanese army. Now, what's so fascinating about this scene is that once he gets these summons, once he is drafted into the military, there are so many people within his village that say it is a great honor to fight with your country. And Saigo wonders, is it really? Is it really a worthwhile honor? Because I could die and never meet my son. But Saigo goes because he must. And eventually, as they are fighting on Iwo Jima, General Kiribashi, who's played by Ken Watanabe, sees Saigo do something absolutely heroic, and he says to him, you are quite a soldier. And it's that point that Saigo looks down and says, really, I'm not. I'm just a baker. I mean, my word, how moving is that scene? It's a beautiful scene because it exposes just how human soldiers can be. And when you look at these two movies, there's not a whole lot of Jesus talk in either movie. There's some in Flags of Our Fathers. There's none in Letters from Iwo Jima. And yet, when people ask me what are some of the best Christian movies I've ever seen, at the top of my list is Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima. And people said, oh, I didn't know that was a Christian movie. Of course it is. We have this problem. We have this idea that a Christian movie is one where no cursing occurs, where someone gives their life to God, and then all of their problems go away, much like 2 Kings 3, where verse 26 ends. The idea is if you trust God more, then everything will work out. And that's what most Christian movies are. But when you look at these other two movies that have cursing in them, that have violence in them, that don't really mention Jesus a whole lot, you realize that what these movies are trying to do, better than most movies, in my opinion, is they are trying to create in you a sense of empathy. Not just for the American soldiers who died in this futile combat on an island across the Pacific, but also for the ones who attacked American soldiers. You feel this great sense of empathy for all soldiers involved. Why? Because there's this unjust cloud that hangs over their death. And this movie creates an enormous amount of empathy within the viewer. What on earth could be more Christian than that? Something that creates empathy. Now, you may say, Craig, where do you get this crazy idea? I have no idea where you're coming up with the fact that empathy is a Christian thing. Well, if you consider the writings of John, John in 1 John 4:12 writes this. He says, "No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, then God lives in us." And what Jesus does that is so brilliant is Jesus says, while he's on the Sermon on the Mount, he says, anyone can love their friends. Anyone can love those who agree with them. But what I'm telling you to do is if you really want to see God, learn how to love your enemy. Letters from Iwo Jima helps us to learn how to love those who disagree with us, who attack us, who are our enemies. That is why these two movies are Christian to their core. Because God lives in the holy practice of empathy. When you practice empathy, it is a holy journey. Because you are ultimately considering the feelings, the thoughts, and the motivations of the people who are your enemies. Now, what do these two stories have to do with our story of child sacrifice and that prophet, Elisha? Where do these all connect? Well, the story of Elisha and the three kings is a very unique story in the Bible because we have the Israelite version of the story in the book of 2 Kings. But we also have the Moabite version of the story. And if you were to go to the Louvre in Paris, France, and search really carefully through some of their archaeological exhibits, you would eventually come across a thing called the Mesha Stele. And the Mesha Stele is dated to be written about the 9th century BCE, and it is a sacred writing of the Moabite people. Now, it is not on parchment, it is not on paper, it is on a giant slab of rock. And on it, we read the story of Mesha, the king of Moab, telling the story of the battle against Israel. So let's read these words from the Mesha Stele. "I am Mesha, son of Chemosh," which was their god, "the king of Moab. I made this high place for Chemosh in Karcho because he, Chemosh, has saved me from all kings and because he has shown me to all my enemies. Omri was the king of Israel, and he oppressed Moab for many days, for Chemosh was angry with his land." Now, this is a side note. According to 2 Kings, Omri was the grandfather of Jehoram, the king of Israel, who was one of the three kings in the story. Let's continue reading the Mesha Stele. "And his son replaced him, and he said, 'I will also oppress Moab. In my days, he said so. But I, Mesha, look down on him and his house, and Israel has been defeated forever.'" So this Mesha Stele is written shortly after the battle with Israel. And in the Mesha Stele and in the Bible, we read the same thing. Moab and Israel went to war, and Moab won. Now we keep reading. "I, Mesha, took the vessels of Yahweh," which is interesting to note because this is the first time that anywhere outside of Scripture someone refers to the God of Israel, specifically Yahweh. Mesha continues to write, "And I, Mesha, brought them before Chemosh, our God. And the king of Israel had built Jahaz, and he stayed there while he fought against me. And Chemosh drove him away from me." Then the rest of the Mesha Stele says, "And then I built this, and I built that, and I built this, and I built that, and I built this, and I built that." Now here's what's interesting. If we were to compare 2 Kings 3 and Mesha Stele, we'd realize that they're telling a very similar story. Namely, 2 Kings would say, well, Yahweh is our God. Whereas the Mesha Stele would say, well, Chemosh is our God. 2 Kings then says, well, our God is the one true God. And the Mesha Stele would say, well, our God, Chemosh, is the one true God. 2 Kings says, but our God likes us more than you. And Mesha Stele responds by saying, but our God likes us more than you. And 2 Kings says, well, let's go to war and see whose God is more powerful. Mesha Stele says essentially, well, let's go to war and see whose God is more powerful. And In the Israelite account, we hear about how Moab has rebelled. In the Moabite account, we hear about how Israel has oppressed Moab. And we have two very different perspectives on the same battle. And when you look at what they're both saying and what they're charging their people, the idea is essentially the same. We have a God. It's the true God. Our God likes us more than all the other countries. We'll go to war, and our God is powerful, so we'll be victorious over all of our enemies. When we consider this battle from both perspectives, there is a question that comes to mind. What is the real evil here? Is it Moab? Is it Chemosh? Or is it Yahweh? I don't think it's any of those things, and the only way you can get there is when you read the story from both perspectives. I think the real evil is spiritual elitism. The idea that God loves us more than you and our God's more powerful than your God, why? Because we're right and you're wrong, ended up killing all sorts of people in this battle. And if the people of Yahweh would have been willing to let go of that belief, or the people of Moab would have been willing to let go of that belief, then we could have avoided all sorts of unnecessary bloodshed. And there's a problem at the core of spiritual elitism, because spiritual elitism basically says, well, God loves me more than others. And whenever you have a love that is based on comparison, that love will always, 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 always create enemies. Every time that you need God to love you more than someone else, you will view other people, other cultures, other religions with suspicion, with fear, with anger, and ultimately have an agenda of elimination. Why? Because you need God to love you more. When we talk about problems that are facing American Christianity today, I think spiritual elitism is near the top. The idea that God loves us and our belief system and our country better than everyone else is what is hindering Christianity in America today. The idea that God likes our story better than others creates enemies out of so many different people. But if we really consider this story from both perspectives, and you feel as much sorrow and pain and doubt from the death of the Moabite soldier as the Israelite soldier, then you have started on a journey. You have started on a practice of holy empathy. Why? Because you are learning to love those who have different stories than you. You are learning to place yourself in the shoes of your enemy. And if you can do that within scripture, you will find that that spills over into your personal life. Because while the stories of the movies of Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima help us with our national enemies, and the stories of the Holy Bible and the Meshech Stele help us with our religious enemies, there is something that becomes extremely difficult about empathy when it comes to our personal enemies, doesn't it? Our personal enemies, who have names and who maliciously attack us, and we struggle to wonder why they do these things, these hurtful things, and we come up with no answer. What do we do with the person who is hell-bent on our destruction? What do we do with that person who constantly says the wrong thing at the wrong time, and it ruins your entire week? Have you ever come across someone that is just so hard to forgive, and you read stories about forgiveness, you go to church and you hear how we need to forgive our enemies, and you think, yes, I'm going to do it. And then Monday comes around and you say, I just can't do it. They don't know the story I've been through. We all have those people who hurt us in ways we can barely begin to describe. I personally have people in my life that I just can't seem to find an easy way to forgive. I have people that I harbor hatred and bitterness toward. Why? Well, from my perspective, they make my life a living hell. So when God says to love our enemies, and when John says we need to understand that we can't see God, but when we learn to love one another, then God lives in us. How do we best do that? I'd like to share a few things that I've learned. The first thing is this: God lives in the holy practice of empathy. I found that it's very difficult to forgive a faceless evil that a person has done. However, I have found a bit more success when I've forgiven the person, the imperfect human that has hurt me. Yeah, it's not easy. It's not like I did this overnight. It was just this constant commitment to saying, okay, this is a human being who has a real spouse, who has real kids, and their story is one that they are trying to craft, just like I am trying to craft my own story. And so I try my best to see the humanity in the person who has hurt me. And it has helped transform my hatred into love, little by little. I think Christina Cleveland says it best, and she's a Duke University seminary professor. She says, "My humanity is closely tied to the extent to which I can perceive myself in my enemy." And so I do whatever I can through the practice of prayer to see things from their perspective, to see myself and the damage that I have caused others in the person who is causing me damage. That's the first thing, that God lives in the holy practice of empathy. The second thing that I found to be helpful is that this whole journey of forgiveness is not a simple overnight practice, but instead, it's an expedition. It takes a while. Time is your friend on this thing. And as the more time goes by, I've learned that it's easier to forgive. Now, that doesn't mean that I have pain and hatred and bitterness and I say, well, I'll figure that out 10 years from now and then I'll finally forgive them. No, what it is I make a commitment every day to be filled with less hatred than I was yesterday. Every day I focus little by little by little of how I can transform inner hatred or bitterness into love and compassion. And there's some days I take 3 steps forward, there's some days I take 2 steps backward, but I always try to keep moving forward. And I like to tell people that empathy is not just a simple practice that you download, it is an expedition you go on. Pack your bags because it's going to take a while. And what I like to tell people is this, is that God lives in the holy expedition of empathy. It is a journey day in, day out, being committed to turn your hatred, your bitterness, your resentment into love, compassion, grace, and mercy. Why do we go on this journey? Why do we go on this excruciating expedition? It's because I believe it makes the world better. Whenever hatred is turned into love, the world becomes a better place. And the best way to do that is on a personal level, first and foremost. The last thing I'd like to share with success that I've found, what little success it is, in forgiving enemies, is this. Celebrate your accomplishments. Now, don't do this in a big, showy, flashy way. Don't post it on Facebook that you're the most loving person. Obviously, that's going against everything that you've tried to work for. But recognize that you've gotten better. Celebrate that you're filled with half the hate that you had a year ago. Hold people close to you that can help celebrate these things with you. Because when somebody has really wronged you, it is very difficult to forgive this person overnight. But what you can do is you can recognize your progress on the expedition. And that progress ultimately leads to a more holistic way of life. So those are the 3 things that I would remind you to do. God lives in the holy practice of empathy. It's an expedition, not just a practice. And lastly, celebrate your accomplishments as you continue to journey from hatred toward love. May you replace your hatred with love. May you consider things from all other perspectives, and may God be with you and may God live in your life as you go on the holy expedition of empathy. Grace and peace to you, my friends.